This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The American media's reaction to the Ebola outbreak in Africa that has claimed thousands of lives and has now reached the U.S. has been described as everything from hysterical to brave. It has, for the first time really, shown a bright light on the lack of medical resources in the developing countries that are faced with this virus and on the heroism of the medical professionals who have stood their ground to help. It's opened our eyes here to our preparation for not just Ebola, but any large-scale public health threat. But increasingly, the media has gotten pushback from those who say it's been far too much, too many stories, too sensationalistic, given the small chance of an American Ebola outbreak, and given the many real and common threats that the public wishes that we would cover more each day. But in many ways, this sentence uttered by Dr. John Wangu tells us the real story.
It's a terrible way to die. They really suffer tremendously.
Wangu treated patients in West Africa, and his description of the effects of Ebola to our Patrick Scahill can help explain the way the story's been told. It's frightening. It's out of control. It's being handled by courageous people in space-age suits. It's a death that nobody wants. Today, Where We Live, how we talk about Ebola and the impact of our coverage and how we react to the crisis. We want to hear from you. Do you think the media has done a good job covering the Ebola virus and the Ebola outbreak? Has the story been covered too much or not enough? Join our conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We'll be bringing in medical and journalism professionals to talk about this, and we do want to hear your voice. Joining us first from our New Haven studio is Dr. John Wangu. He's professor of public health at Southern Connecticut State University. He's an epidemiologist and works in infectious diseases. He's a consultant for the World Health Organization and has worked in West Africa. Dr. Wangu, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
First, let's ask a little bit about your experience as someone who's witnessed this outbreak both here in the U.S. and also in Africa. What can you tell us about the ways you've seen the different places handle the Ebola outbreak and the way the messaging goes out to the public and the way it's talked about?
I think in Africa, for example, which is where they've had quite a few of the epidemics, in some parts, there is no mass media at all. And so it's very difficult, and people simply pass on information, word of mouth, and that's also how conspiracy theories would emerge, because since there is no mass media, it's very difficult to be able to correct and present the actual correct information and correct the conspiracy theories. And where there is some media existing, often they're not as independent as they are in developed world. And so in most cases, they are government controlled or run mass media. And so information is simply what is being presented by the government. Of course, in contrast, in the developed world, such as United States, of course, when I say developed, I mean the capitalist developed countries, because mass media, it's relatively independent, and people have much freedom, and there is much resources to be able to aggressively address the issue. And people demand and expect the mass media to have a discussion on the issues.
Of course, much as it is in America, there's not just one mass media, and in the African nations that have been affected, we can't say that there's just one country or one style of media, even one style of handling this outbreak. We've seen that in a country like Liberia, there have been enormous waves of problems that have stemmed from this Ebola outbreak. Meanwhile, early on in the crisis, we saw Nigeria, which had a case reported, was able to clamp down on it medically and also seemingly clamp down on any conspiracy theories, any hysteria. It seems as though Nigeria, a very, very large, important country in Africa, has been largely spared some of the issues. Do you see differences in the way the different African nations, Doctor, have handled this outbreak, both medically and in the messaging around it?
Yes, indeed. And in my previous interview, I had mentioned what I thought was one of the differences, which is the public health infrastructure. I think when there isn't much of a public health infrastructure, then it's extremely difficult to be able to control the disease, because specific to Ebola, the goal is to break the chain of infection. And the way you do it is to isolate the infected from the healthy. And if you don't have facilities where you will put away those infected individuals, then the disease control becomes non-effective. And in terms of the mass media coverage, relatively speaking, Nigeria, it's a bit more developed in terms of resources in comparison to Liberia, Guinea, or Sierra Leone. And that makes a difference in terms of how the media is presented, or how the disease control effectiveness comes across. I must say, in Nigeria, there was also all kinds of conspiracy theories. It's a human thing to come up with conspiracy theories when you don't understand. You have no idea. All of a sudden, somebody you love drops dead. I mean, and they tell you some disease or some, you know. And so you're going to be concerned. And that's part of what produces the hysteria, regardless what part of the world, because humans are humans.
Later on in the program, we're going to be talking a bit more about the perceptions of risk and how hysteria builds in the media as we talk about how we talk about Ebola on the show today. Joining us from our New Haven studios today is Dr. John Wangu, his professor of public health at Southern Connecticut State University, who's worked during the Ebola crisis in West Africa. He's also a consultant for the World Health Organization. We'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. And in a moment, move to the American coverage of how we're looking at this Ebola crisis, as some cases have now cropped up in the U.S. But before we turn away from Africa for the moment, I want you to listen to something else, Doctor. Connecticut native Becca Ross Russell is a founder and executive director of The Small Things. It's a nonprofit working in Tanzania with orphans and vulnerable children. She was back in the U.S. and spoke with WNPR's Diane Orson, and they talked about the effect of the Ebola crisis on her work in Tanzania.
The biggest effect that we've seen is we have no volunteers. We've had almost no volunteer applications and almost no volunteers coming over this year, which is difficult because we really rely on the help and the attention that volunteers give the kids. And we are further away in East Africa from Ebola than London is. But people tend to think of Africa as a monolithic entity and feel like, well, if it's in West Africa, then, you know, it must be everywhere, or they're afraid of the entire continent. In a lot of ways, we're at lower risk in Tanzania because your average person does so little traveling. And there's a much better, it's a very stable country with a history of, you know, trust of authority in a way that is not the case in many of these Western African countries where things have gotten out of control.
Have you heard of declines, let's say, in tourism or travel to not only Tanzania, but like neighboring countries?
I definitely have heard about it. I don't know the exact numbers, but I know that a lot of people are hurting. And in Tanzania in particular, a huge, huge proportion of the economy is tourism-based. But these things go in cycles, and I'm sure that, you know, it'll come back once people calm down a little bit, and hopefully it'll never reach us in East Africa, and it won't be a problem.
That's Becca Ross Russell talking with our own Diane Orson. Becca Ross Russell works for a nonprofit in Tanzania. And, Doctor, as I listen to that, and as she says it, we're further away in East Africa from Ebola than London is, but people tend to think of Africa as a monolithic entity. And this is, I think, one of the things we really wanted to get to and get your perceptions of today. This thought that Africa is one place and it's all under this threat of Ebola, when indeed it is a very, very big place with a lot of different governmental structures and certainly a lot of different risk factors around something like the Ebola virus.
Yes. I must say it's a normal human reaction. Again, it goes back to ignorance, you know, lack of understanding or knowledge of what we're dealing with in terms of the disease in question. I think overall, though, Americans, with exceptions of those who are better informed, indeed do think of Africa as a country as opposed to a continent. And as a result, they would imagine in their minds that the disease is very likely to be in every part or some parts of Africa. And I must say, the chances that a disease like that would come to a developed country like United States or London and so forth, Europe, etc., it's much higher compared to other parts of Africa, because there isn't as much inter-Africa travels, but there is typically, for those who travel, Africa towards a developed country travel.
Mm.
And so the chances that it will go to a developed country is actually much higher.
We're talking about how we discuss the Ebola virus and the outbreak today. Stand by, Dr. Wang Gu. I want to bring in Marcel Dufresne, who's an associate professor of journalism at UConn, who's been taking a look at this coverage. And Marcel, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, you're very welcome, John.
We were just talking about the perceptions of Africa, the way Americans may or may not think of this continent as one country, or how much we understand about the various political divisions and the places themselves. What have you seen about how our perception of Africa, this notion of it being a place far away, has informed the public discussion and the media coverage of this outbreak?
Well, interestingly, I was in Kenya about 5 years ago with a medical team from Connecticut that was just setting up small medical clinics. When we came back and we had written some things for the Hartford Courant about this this trip, and I realized just what the doctor was saying about the perception in the U.S. of Africa just being a single country and people not understanding the politics and kind of lumping it together as one place. I think that feeds into the lack of understanding of that Americans may have about foreign countries in general, but Africa in particular, really are illustrated by some of the stories that have come out recently about travel bans and screening and that type of, and closing the borders. And I think a lot of that has been fed by politicians who perceive a public distrust of how things are being handled. So they will promote this type of thing, even though there are some real doubts about how effective it might be, at least from screenings in this country. The points that I've read are that the screenings from the countries in question would be a lot more effective. But I think that doesn't stop the way the media tends to cover it.
I'm wondering if you could give us a broad review, though, from your perspective, Marcel, on how the media is done. I've been talking with a number of people about this, and I'm somewhat mixed, because clearly there's been an awful lot of hysteria. Clearly there's been some breathless reporting on things that aren't a big risk to us in the United States. That said, the intense coverage of this has, I think, as I said in the introduction, shown a bit of a light on the lack of resources in West Africa for the medical community. It's shown a big light on things that we might need to think about if we want to help people in that part of the world. It's certainly gotten us talking a lot more about our own protocols for how we deal with any infectious disease here at home. In many ways, it seems as though this hysterical reporting at times has given us some real information that's probably useful. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And this is true of any story that the media gets criticized for, is that you can look below the surface of the dominant media and find excellent coverage. People complain that the environment isn't covered. Whatever the story is, there is great coverage out there if you go looking for it. I think the real concern as a culture, I think you look at studies, and it's always been the case, since the arrival of television news, that TV has been the dominant medium and that most people get their news from television. When you add the notion of social media to that, you've got a vast majority of people getting all or most of their information from television news, cable news in particular, and social media, neither of which are really well-equipped to report this kind of story in depth because of their formats and their approach. So I think there's no question there's great coverage out there on all the points that you mentioned, but the majority of people get most of their information from sources that don't do a very good job reporting that or do it in a much more low-key aspect. And the dominant themes that you'll see in those venues are very much more hysterical.
We're talking with media professionals and medical professionals about how we talk about Ebola. We want to take your calls when we come back from our break at 860-275-7266. We're also going to be talking about perceptions of threat, how it can lead to hysteria. We got this tweet from Susan Bigelow. The cable news networks have been especially bad. Breathless 24-hour coverage. What we need is facts from trustworthy sources. If you want to tweet us your thoughts, tweet us at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about how we talk about Ebola. The media coverage of the outbreak has been called hysterical at times and has been accused of ignoring important issues in Africa while concentrating on small threats at home. That's why we wanted to bring in our next guest, Paul Slovic, who studies perceptions of threat. He's founder and president of Decision Research, and he joins us by phone today. Paul Slovic, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
How does public hysteria come about? What causes it?
I'm not sure that we can really call it hysteria. Basically, we judge risk most of the time by our feelings, as opposed to any kind of analysis that we do of arguments and reasons. And there's things about Ebola that are actually quite scary. And so when we think about it, we have these feelings and we react to them. It's kind of hard to put that in balance with kind of the what the medical profession is telling us.
One of the things we've seen an awful lot of is many people making the case that there are many more threats in our lives, including just the seasonal flu, that we should be worried much more about than Ebola. But maybe you can square that with how we do often think about very, very scary things. As we said off the top, Dr. Wangu told us, Ebola is a terrible way to die, and I think, as you suggest, that's a big reason why people are covering it this way. It's a death that nobody wants. It's a disease that everyone is scared about. That's different than the flu, even though the flu is probably much more likely to kill you.
Right, and it's also basically new to us, even though it's been around for a long time. But this, what we're seeing now, is seen as something new. Whereas the flu is familiar to us. So basically, Ebola hits what we call, all the risk perception hot buttons. It is seen as, not easily controlled. I mean, we have no medicines for it, no vaccines. And so it's something that is transmitted. It's invisible. We can't see it coming and therefore avoid it. And as you mentioned, it's a dreadful way to die. So these things scare us, and and that's why we react so strongly to them.
I've asked our journalist Marcel Dufresne to give us a sense of how he's thought of the media coverage so far. How have you viewed this, Paul Slovic? Do you think that the media has done a good job in reporting the facts while trying to tamp down some of the innate hysteria that's just going to happen in a situation like this?
Basically, I think the media has done a good job of bringing to us what the medical authorities tell us about Ebola, that it is not not highly contagious. There's only certain routes to transmission, and compared to certain other things, this is not highly contagious, and that that the authorities know how to contain it through isolation of infected people and so forth. So, but at the same time, there's a lot of focus on mistakes that have been made, which I think also is fair, because even the hospital personnel involved have said, we made mistakes. And so that, that's frightening to people when people see that there are these mistakes being made. That carries a lot of weight and challenges the trust that we need to have in the medical profession in order to kind of keep calm about it.
Part of the thing, of course, is the words we choose to use. I want to bring back into the conversation Dr. John Wangu, who's from Southern Connecticut State University, who's worked in West Africa with Ebola patients. One of the things that I know that you always watch is how we refer to cases like this. Sometimes we use the word epidemic, and we use the word epidemic an awful lot. Are you worried at all, doctor, about the way we throw around words like that, maybe spreading some fear that a few cases in Dallas or a few people being treated in Atlanta might mean an epidemic of Ebola here in the United States?
I think the terms we use make a difference indeed. However, in this case, one case of Ebola could be considered an epidemic. In other words, we declare an epidemic in the context of increase of a particular disease cases in comparison to past experience. So, for example, in a place where there's never really been any case at all of Ebola, now one case could be declared or considered an epidemic, especially when the disease is very fatal. However, I think the context in which the terms are used is what makes the difference and the emphasis.
Marcel Dufresne, what are your thoughts on the use of this term epidemic?
Well, I was initially startled when I saw it, and I because of I guess the layman's understanding of epidemic. And I think if you look at popular culture, which I don't think you can underestimate in this kind of situation, the number of apocalyptic programs and movies, and there was a popular movie called Contagion a couple of years ago that was was very powerful in that it showed how something like this can spread. And I think when people hear the word epidemic, they associate it with, again, what their messages from popular culture has been, and they're frightening. And so I even though there's a technically a scientific definition that Dr. Wangu has explained, I'm not sure that that's the layman's perception of that term. And when they see it used as a banner and a teaser on news coverage, then I think that becomes frightening. Even though there is clearly an epidemic in Africa, I don't think most people in this country, when they look at the facts, would think that that's the case here.
Marcel, you've covered other medical issues like this, including widespread, very scary ones. Have you seen anything in your career that reminds you of what we're seeing now with Ebola? Any other stories that maybe ring some bells for you?
Well, I did. I was a medical reporter in the 80s when AIDS first really broke on the scene. And it's interesting because I remember interviewing Dr. Fauci from the CDC, who's constantly on the news now. He's been a mainstay in infectious diseases for going on 4 decades. And I think the coverage of AIDS had some parallels. I don't want to overstate them, but there was a lot of hysteria about how people contracted it. I recall doing a story about a hospital in Connecticut that where people had mistakenly assumed that someone who was in for treatment had AIDS, and the medical staff discussed it, and you know, in kind of as a rumor, and people were avoiding this patient's room. I mean, so there's a long, you know, concern with the unknown in these types of stories. But I think it goes back to how much do we trust our medical experts? And you know, there's been a very anti-science movement in this country, anti-expert, a distrust of officials. And you compound that with a few missteps early on in this process, in the Ebola case, and I think people that just it fuels those suspicions that they already have.
Well, I'm wondering, Paul Slovic, if you can weigh in on that. How does mistrust of public officials, if you've seen someone fail, whether it's a government agency in Africa or it's a hospital in Dallas, once you begin to mistrust public officials, does that change the perceptions of risk of how you might think about something like Ebola?
Well, absolutely. Trust is very closely linked to perception of risk. And when you start to lose trust, then risk perception increases very greatly. And one of the things we know about trust is what we call, you know, its asymmetric nature. We all kind of know this from personal experience that it's, you know, it's slow to, you know, you're slow to earn trust and build it up, but you can lose it in an instant with one misstep. You know, the negative far outweighs the positive. So you have, you know, something good that happens, and then something bad happens. Well, that bad thing will destroy trust more than the good thing builds trust. And so when we hear about the mistakes that were made, this does challenge our trust in officials. Very central.
Paul, I know that you've studied another small, scary threat that we faced here in Connecticut, the anthrax problem right after 9/11, when we had packages delivered across the United States, and including a woman here in Connecticut who died after opening up an envelope that contained anthrax. Do you see any parallels there in the way we covered anthrax and the way we're covering Ebola?
Well, I don't recall the specific news coverage of anthrax at the time, but anthrax, again, it shares the quality of being, you know, invisible, you know, new, invisible, and deadly. And so, you know, that again triggers very high perception of risk.
Paul Slovic is founder and president of Decision Research. Thank you, Paul, so much for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
John, I wanted to add one point about the media as it operates today. It's
yes.
Something relatively new that we've seen. It's often termed process journalism, which is basically a lot of media now are, because of the instantaneous nature of information, they're the ethic of confirming and verifying before publication has really declined. And there's this notion, and again, it's often called process journalism, that you basically publish what you have at the moment, figure out the story as you go, and correct your mistakes as you update, which, you know, can be really dangerous. We've seen it in some breaking stories, but on a story like this, you know, it also can have some ramifications that people don't necessarily get the updates. They just see the initial stories, which may be erroneous.
We're talking with Marcel Dufresne, who is an associate professor of journalism at UConn. We have another journalist joining us in studio now. Ariel Levin Becker joins us periodically to talk about health. She's a health reporter at the Connecticut Mirror, and she's been covering this story as it's reached Connecticut. Ariel, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if you could just talk a little bit about what Marcel just said. The process of covering a story like this for the media, look, the stakes are always very high. It's very important for us to get things right. But when it's a public health issue, it seems to me, at least, as an editor, and I know to you as a reporter, that there are slightly different stakes, that the way that we talk about something so as to inform, enlighten, but then also not scare people, there's a very thin line. How do you go about that? How do you make some of those decisions?
You know, I think as a reporter, providing context is really, in any story you're doing, one of your main jobs. And certainly when you're dealing with a medical issue, a contagious disease, that becomes, you know, sort of heightened. And, you know, the professor is absolutely right that there is increasingly a pressure to report things immediately as soon as you get it. I mean, my feeling on that is that Our only value to people is providing information that is accurate and useful and appropriately in context. So you lose all that value if you report something quickly. But there's tremendous pressure to do that. And unfortunately, if something gets erroneously reported, you don't want to jump in the bandwagon. But if you don't have the fact that it's untrue confirmed, it's sort of left out there and nobody's correcting it yet. So that does become a challenge, how you respond to everything else that's out there.
But another key part to this is, in a story like this, you really are at the mercy of public health officials. There's only so many people who have the information that you need to be able to tell the story. And so often, people who report on a health crisis are waiting around for the officials, whether it's from the hospital or from the CDC, to say what they know. And there's almost no way in the moment for you to get any more information than them. So how do you work with that when the official word is sometimes the only word you can get?
You know, in some cases, that means just saying this is what we know, this is what we don't know at this point. For example, last week there was someone at Yale who had a suspected case of Ebola. And so we reported that there was a case that was being treated as potential Ebola and it wasn't confirmed. And we tried as much as possible to put that in context. I mean, I think the other way you can write about these sort of issues is by looking at the bigger questions that emerge from it. So, for example, what is our public health infrastructure like? How prepared are we to address an outbreak in Connecticut or as a country? Those are the sorts of things that I think are worth looking at. And it's a way to address people's concerns about Ebola without necessarily writing every day, you know, there may have been somebody with a fever in the emergency room today. It's a way of addressing what I think are sort of the root of some of the larger concerns without necessarily having to do this sort of making a story where there isn't one necessarily.
And Marcel, before I let you go, I think that's important too. The threads that we as journalists pull out of a story like this are very important as we continue to. And I know Ariel has covered quite extensively what happens at hospitals in the state when emergency rooms get overcrowded, when there's not enough staff to be able to take care of people on a day-to-day basis, and those are people who are coming in with broken legs and gunshot wounds and the flu. If you add on the possibility of a public health crisis, you can see very quickly how that breaks down. It seems as though the decision, Marcel, to cover stories about how we largely treat people medically in America may be able to stem from this, and it may provide some good out of coverage like this.
Well, I think you're right. I do think it should, I hope, teach the public to be more careful and to seek out better sources of information. I think you know, on the point of concern, distrust of medical officials and whatnot, I think we've seen some stories that are also disturbing when it comes to how other types of officials respond to these stories with kind of hysterical responses, and I know you're familiar with the case of the photographer from the Washington Post who was disinvited to a talk because he had just finished his restricted activity, and then we've had cases of teachers put on leave because they had traveled to Dallas, things like that. And so when our other officials start to react hysterically, I know there's a public concern, but that adds to the undermining of trust in the medical people.
Marcel Dufresne is Associate Professor of Journalism at the University of Connecticut. Marcel, thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it.
You're very welcome, John. Great show.
Ariel, did you want to jump in quickly before we go to break?
Yeah, I think one thing that's also challenging about a situation like Ebola is that it is complex. There isn't sort of a very, very simple message. On the one hand, it is a disease that has a very high mortality rate, and if you are exposed to the bodily fluids of somebody who has Ebola, it's very contagious. That said, the vast, vast majority of the population is extremely unlikely to ever be exposed to it in a way that it would be contagious to them. But that's the message that, you know, doesn't lend itself to 140 characters to put in a tweet or to a headline. And so, you know, we're sort of bombarded with headlines. And so it's something that sort of begs for people to read a little bit deeper, but that doesn't always happen.
And I think, honestly, the pushback that some of the media has gotten has been in that 140 character form, which has been essentially chill out, people. It's not as bad as you think, which also doesn't tell the entire story. Ariel Levenbecker tries to get to the entire story as a health reporter at the Connecticut Mirror. She joins us in studio. Joining us from our New Haven studio today is Dr. John Wongu, who is a professor in epidemiology and infectious diseases. When we come back, Kristen Hare, who's a reporter with the Poynter Institute. We'll talk more about media coverage. We'll get some more of your thoughts. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's normally the day for our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, but we're pushing it back one day as we get closer to Election Day. Republican candidate for Governor Tom Foley will stop by for his final appearance on our Where We Vote series for the 2014 campaign. You'll get a chance to ask him questions. You can tweet us questions at Where We Live or call in tomorrow. Hope you can join us for that. Today on the show, we're talking about how we talk about Ebola. We're talking about the media coverage, some of the hysteria, and also some of the positive that might come out of a deep dive into this very scary disease. R.L. Levin Becker is health reporter at the Connecticut Mirror. She joins us in studio. Joining us from New Haven today is Dr. John Wangu, who is a professor of public health at Southern Connecticut State University, who's treated Ebola patients in West Africa. And joining us now by phone is Kristen Hare. She's a reporter with the Poynter Institute. She's been taking a look at how the media has been covering this. And Kristen, welcome to our show. Thank you so much.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
I know that I've asked this of our other journalists and our other experts today, too. But broadly, I'm wondering if you could handicap how you think the media has done in covering these Ebola cases, specifically the ones that have reached Dallas, Texas, the ones that have reached the American shore. Do you think we're overdoing it, or do you think that the coverage has actually provided some context?
Well, I think it depends on who you're looking at that coverage from. I did a story last week about the public radio station in Dallas and the Dallas Morning News and how they have covered it. I think that's been, from Dallas, I think that's been very fair and calm, and they're taking, you know, a very measured approach. I think if you're watching cable news, it could very much feel like the sky is falling. And so I think it really depends on where you get your information from.
Of course, one of the things that Marcel Dufresne was talking about earlier that it's very important for our conversation here is he recalled what happened when he was first covering the AIDS epidemic and the way not just the media but the public reacted to AIDS patients. And in part, there are some parallels here because it's set up as an us against them. At the time when AIDS hit, homosexual culture was not as widely accepted in America as it is today. People were scared an awful lot about this outbreak, and so the media reacted that way. In many ways, Kristen, it seems as though the media is reacting to a threat from Africa that has really no basis in fact, but is part of what's getting people scared about this.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've noticed as I've watched coverage is just a general sense of fear and terror. And I think that does reflect how most of the American public feels about Ebola, whether they really understand what it is and how it's transmitted or not. And so you see that in headlines, in newspapers across the country. You see the word terror a lot and fear, and you see those things sort of manifesting themselves into print and online. So I think that shows kind of how journalists are coping with this thing that still feels unknown to us in America.
We talked about the photographer who is disinvited from Syracuse University because he'd recently been to West Africa. I know that the images coming back from that place is something that you're looking very closely at. What can you talk about the photographs, the images that we're seeing specifically coming from West Africa, and what sort of story they're telling us about the Ebola outbreak there?
So I interviewed Ben Solomon, who is a video photojournalist with the New York Times in August, and he has been in Sierra Leone and in Liberia. And he and I talked about the measures he was going to stay safe every day, which were, you know, quite extreme, and then also what he had to do to tell that story. And his images and a lot of the other images I've seen from photojournalists in West Africa have been of people. A lot of times they've been of people suffering, people dying, their family members coping, the hospitals there struggling. And what struck me about those images is how different they are than what we have seen here in the U.S. and I think what we're going to see because of privacy laws.
Mm. I want to bring in R.L. Levin Becker again. We talked briefly before the break about the scare that we had last week with a possible case. It was a suspected case of Ebola, which turned out to be negative, but all of the Connecticut media kind of mustered and thought, okay, this is a story that we have to cover. I'm just wondering if you can walk us through, as a health reporter, how you began to think about how you're going to cover a story like this, where, again, you're only getting some official information, And you very, you know, possibly could be dealing with something where you're going to be covering it every day, even if you know that it's probably not a great threat to most people in Connecticut. How do you go about doing that, and how do your editors do that?
I think a lot of it is just really, first of all, starting with what you know and what's confirmed. You know, Yale New Haven Hospital in this situation put out a statement that said, we have a patient who came in last night who was exhibiting Ebola-like symptoms, and it is not confirmed at this point. We're working on it. So essentially there was sort of that little bit of information, and you know, we were able to learn that the patient had been in Liberia, and so there was some sort of reason to, or it had been in West Africa, and so you know, it wasn't just somebody coming in with a fever. And so you know, I think, as I said earlier, I think a lot of it is really just providing context and saying, you know, this is how people get the disease. You know, you have to be exposed to bodily fluids. It's not an airborne illness. You know, in cases where people have been to West Africa and show symptoms, that would be when somebody might potentially be suspected of having Ebola. But a lot of it is waiting and sort of trying to find out more. But of course, you know, at that point, sort of the two big questions were, one, does this person have Ebola? And two, how is the hospital and the health system responding to it? Did they handle this sort of in the way that they should? And so those are things that, you know, as the day goes on, as you get more and more information, a lot of the information doesn't necessarily answer those questions, but you sort of keep gathering. And you know, unfortunately, we're not conditioned for patience in this world right now, but that's sort of sometimes what we have to have.
Dr. Wong, we got a call earlier from someone who could not stay on the line, but who said that she fears that an awful lot of the media coverage of Ebola has just been factually incorrect, that there's stuff being reported about the way the disease is transmitted or about Ebola itself that has just not been right. Have you seen that? Have you felt as though much of the way the media has given information out about Ebola has been correct, or has it been incorrect?
I think information put out by the mass media, in my opinion, seems correct. I just think that the emphasis and the, for lack of term, drumming up of the concern is probably what makes people think that they're not getting the right information. Because, I mean, the mass media has repeatedly said you do not get it casually. It has to be through direct contact with bodily fluid. I've heard all those said by the mass media. But I think human beings sometimes hear what they want to hear, especially when they are very worried and they're suspicious and they're not trusting of the information being provided.
Kristen Hare, I was wondering if you can pick up on that, because I think one of the roles of the media, specifically the broadcast media, in any sort of a public health emergency, crisis, or even just scare, is maybe different than at other times. I mean, our role in part is to be informational, to tell people where they can go when there's a hurricane coming, for instance. And in many ways, this is like that. All the breathless coverage about overseas flights and everything else notwithstanding, it seems as though, Kristen, a big part of our role should be to tell people calmly what exactly is happening, what exactly you can do about it, and what public officials are saying so as to calm nerves a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is a really great chance for local reporters to shine, regardless of their medium. It's time to call your sources at, you know, public policy institutes, public health institutions, find out what their plan is. I saw a really good front page story today about that, about kind of an Ebola drill. And it's really important to ask those questions of the powers in your community and to show your readers that you're getting answers or that you're not. I think it's also really important to offer some context just about, you know, the numbers of, you know, Americans who have been killed by this disease versus some other public health issues that we face. I've seen great reporting on that. So it's definitely a time to offer, I think, some calm and some context with the media.
Ariel?
Yeah, two things. One, I think, I mean, one way to sort of avoid trying to ramp up things is just to not label things. We're talking about the term epidemic, and certainly it may be correctly used, but it means different things in the public imagination. So say, you know, there have been 3 cases in the United States, 1 person has died, things like that. Reporting the information rather than labeling it, I think, can go a long way. The other thing that I think makes this really challenging, though, for perception is that at the same time, the message is really for, you know, for most of us, the risk of any kind of exposure to Ebola is extremely low. We're also seeing hospitals taking huge amounts of precautions and doing a lot of training, because for healthcare workers who would be treating somebody who comes in, even with a suspected case, you know, there is a risk. So I think it can be challenging for people to hear, on the one hand, no, you're not at risk, but then also seeing, you know, these particular sectors of society that really are sort of taking it very seriously, appropriately perhaps. But again, it's a complex message, and I think sometimes people don't respond well when they're told, oh, don't you worry, but these people are worried.
I know, Kristen, that the Associated Press has put out some advisories on how to cover this. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, they put out an advisory on Friday, noting it was an advisory to editors, noting how they were going to handle suspected cases of Ebola, and basically that they had a very specific criteria for moving those stories. So they were not going to be reporting on every suspected case. They said, to report such a case, we look for solid source saying Ebola is suspected. And they asked, you know, are buildings being closed? Are people being evacuated or isolated? Is a plane being diverted? So they have some real specific criteria. And this story, when we wrote about it for Pointer, resounded really well. People really responded to it, I think, because it was nice to hear that, you know, the Associated Press, who I think often sets the tone for print journalists, was really, again, seeking to calm people down a little bit and tell people, we don't have to report on every time someone comes to the hospital with a fever. Let's be responsible in how we report on Ebola.
And Ariel, I know that that's guidance that you look to and that we look to as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think AP had some really interesting guidance on that. I think just one thing, though, I think it's helpful to recognize the difference between the Associated Press and sort of a lot of other local media, because there's been pushback about coverage of suspected cases. And, you know, the AP is an international news wire, and so something that they report goes to publications all over the country, all over the world. It's not generally where somebody who hears about a suspected case of Ebola at their local hospital would go for information. I think that for a local newspaper or an online publication, a TV station that covers local things where people are going to go, you do want to be that resource if people hear about a suspected case, so that you can provide context and perhaps more information and to address people's fears. So I think that in some cases, reporting on something might be warranted for a local publication when it might not meet the AP standard. Certainly, I don't think you should be covering every single time somebody comes to the emergency room with a fever. But I do think that there are some differences in the role that different media play.
Well, one of the conversations we had last week around this New Haven case was there was going to be a series of preliminary results that we would get. And then if they were negative, then we wouldn't have to worry so much. And then if it was positive, then maybe we'd have another set of tests. Our question was, do we report on preliminary results in a case like this? And it is honestly an open question. I don't know, Ariel, that there's a great playbook for it, but I think it's one that we're working out every day. Ariel Levin-Becker is a great health reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. You can read more at ctmirror.org. Thanks as always, Ariel.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Kristen Hare, who's a reporter with the Pointer Institute. They cover journalists and how journalists do their job. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Dr. John Wongu, who's a professor of public health at Southern Connecticut State University. He's a consultant for the World Health Organization. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives, with help today from Jonathan McNichol. The executive producer is Katie Solarski. Our intern today is Nia Tyler. And this is Where We Live.